Chapter 33, Preparing for Greece. A year or two before my departure for England, one of my friends in Kalimpong had given me a copy of Henry Miller's The Colossus of Marusi. I had not read anything by Miller before, and his books may not have been generally available in India at that time. This one was the result of an 8-month trip through Greece in 1939, and though I did not find Kit Symbolis, the colossus of the book's title, as attractive a character as the author himself evidently did, the book as a whole impressed me deeply and gave me a liking for Miller's writing at its lyric, improvisatory best that lasted for many years. I was particularly struck by his account of his visit to Delphi, which, seen on the afternoon of his arrival through a strange twilight mist, seemed even more sublime and awe-inspiring than he had imagined it to be. The following day, after wandering about amid the broken columns, he and his friends had ascended the tortuous path to the stadium on high. He wrote, "The setting is spectacular. Set just below the crest of the mountain, one has the impression that when the course was finished, the charioteers must have driven the steeds over the ridge and into the blue. The atmosphere is superhuman, intoxicating to the point of madness. Everything that is extraordinary and miraculous about Delphi gathers here in the memory of the games that were held in the clouds." Evocative as were such passages as this, I was struck less by Miller's description of the sights of Delphi than by the fact that his visit had affected him so deeply. The oracle may have ceased long ago, but it was evident that Delphi was still very much a sacred place, and though there seemed little likelihood then of my visiting England, much less still Greece, there arose in me, as I read those enthusiastic pages, a desire to see Delphi with my own eyes. I must have spoken to Terry about this desire of mine quite early in our friendship, and in the course of the next few months we must have talked quite a lot about Greece and about the possibility of our visiting it together. It was not until late summer or early autumn, however, that we eventually decided to make the trip, and not until February, when Terry was no longer working, that we were in a position to start actually planning our journey. Less than a year earlier, after one of my lectures at the College of Psychic Science, I had asked Terry how far in the direction of the Vihara he was willing to drive me. "As far as I liked," he had replied. Could he drive me to India? Yes, he could. In retrospect, the exchange seemed significant, even prophetic. The possibility of our visiting Greece together had been first mooted in connection with the idea that Terry might accompany me to India, for by this time it had become obvious that my work now lay in the West, and that sooner or later I would have to pay a farewell visit to the land of the Buddha and take proper leave of my friends, disciples and teachers there. We would drive all the way to the subcontinent in the little bus and visit Greece and see Delphi on the way. This was by no means impossible, but we soon realised the impracticability of the plan, which, in fact, was really never anything more than a dream. Instead of going overland to India, we would go overland to Greece. We would leave England for the continent in the middle of June and be away for 2 months. The India visit would take place separately, probably in the autumn or winter. By the time we returned from the Easter retreat, therefore, our Greek adventure was only 5 weeks away. They would be 5 busy weeks. Not only were there the final arrangements for our journey to be made, there was the festival of Wesak to be celebrated, a retreat to be attended, parents and friends to be visited, and the details of the Vihara's programme for July and August to be finalised. The Wesak celebrations followed much the same pattern as those of the previous year. There was a public meeting at Caxton Hall, Westminster, under the auspices of the Buddhist Society, at which the speakers were me, Dr. Malala Sakera, and Christmas Humphreys, who, as president of the society, was, of course, also in the chair. Probably fewer people attended than last time, but this year there was, I thought, a happier atmosphere. There was certainly a happy atmosphere at the devotional meeting I conducted at the Vihara late that night, as well as at the Vihara's own Wesak celebrations a few days later. The public meeting began with a little procession consisting mainly of the children of members bringing in flowers. After I had placed the flowers on the green and gold shrine, where candles and incense were already burning before the image of the Buddha, there were speeches by Trungpa Rinpoche, Dr. Malalasa Kira, Morris, Tien Chao, and me. There were also readings from the scriptures by Beryl and Jack, and the proceedings concluded with a vote of thanks by Alf, who had recently taken over from Morris as chairman of the Sangha Trust. After the meeting, Morris, Ruth and I, together with other members and friends, talked at length with an important guest who had turned up unexpectedly. This was Dr. Manzin Nakada, the Soto Zen bishop whom I had met at the Buddhist Society's Wesak party the previous week. In the course of discussion, he intimated that an invitation to come and teach in England for a while might not find him unresponsive. Though the Wesak celebrations themselves followed the usual pattern, on the morning of the thrice sacred day, there took place at the Vihara a ceremony that marked, according to the Buddhist, a turning point in the history of the English Sangha. This ceremony was the ordination of Eric as a Shramanera, and it marked a turning point in the history of the English Sangha in that it represented the first time that an English novice monk had been ordained on English soil by an English-born stavira or elder. Apart from the fact that the ceremony was conducted in Pali with a running commentary in English, that I was assisted by Tien Chao and that I gave Eric the name Virya, I remember little or nothing of the proceedings. There does, however, survive a group photograph that was taken in front of the shrine after the ceremony. I am standing nearest the camera, with Tien Chao behind me to my right. I am wearing a Tibetan-style shirt and jacket beneath my Theravadin robes, and my hair, I notice, is rather longer than it used to be in India. Virya is standing behind me to my left, his head freshly shaved for the ceremony. In front of him, further to my left, stands his adoptive mother, and behind Tien Chao, his adoptive father. Behind Virya and his adoptive mother stand Virya's friends, Mr. and Mrs. Lawrence. She is wearing an enormous fur hat, shaped rather like an inverted bucket, that comes down almost below her eyes. Mr. Lawrence is something in the city, and Mrs. Lawrence's second or third cousin to someone who is or was private secretary to the Queen. For reasons that I was never able to fathom, Virya idolises the Lawrences and spends quite a lot of time in the company of them and their three teenage daughters. We all look rather serious, except for Virya's adoptive mother, who attempts a brave smile, but who I know is afraid that Virya may have become a Buddhist monk because she and her husband have failed him in some way. Light comes from the window to our right, highlighting the right side of my face, as well as that of Virya and his adoptive mother, leaving everyone else's faces in the shade. In my speeches at the two public meetings, at Caxton Hall and the Vihara, I had spoken of the significance of Wesak in general terms, reminding my audience that it was the anniversary of the Buddha's attainment of enlightenment, and emphasising that we too could attain enlightenment if we followed the Buddha's path of ethical conduct, concentration and meditation, and transcendental wisdom, as many in the West were already doing. My editorial in the May issue of The Buddhist struck a similar note, besides which I pointed out that Vaishakha, the Sanskrit equivalent of the more familiar Sinhalese Wesak, should be a time of moral and spiritual stock-taking, of ruthless self-examination. This stock-taking was not only individual, but collective, and since at this time of year, Buddhist groups in some parts of the Buddhist world surveyed the progress made during the previous 12 months, I proceeded to do a little stock-taking on behalf of the Sangha Association. I also ventured a prediction. I wrote, "While complacency would be out of place, the English Buddhist movement, as centred on the Hampstead Buddhist Vihara, can look back over the past year with a feeling of sober satisfaction. Systematic teaching of the Dharma, together with the regular practice of guided group meditation, attendance at the speaker's class, and participation in the devotional meetings, have between them not only built up membership of the association, but helped create the nucleus of a spiritual community of people who, taking the Buddha as their ideal, his Dharma as their way of life, and the members of the Sangha as their guides, are gradually coming to constitute a living presence of Buddhism in Great Britain. Various Buddhist traditions have contributed to this development. Theravada, Mahayana, Tibetan Buddhism, and Zen are all honoured at the Vihara. If anything has become clear during the last year, it is the fact that while English Buddhism, or British Buddhism as some prefer to call it, will draw gratefully on all Buddhist traditions, it will not confine itself exclusively to any one of them. Indeed, it is clear that a distinctive Western Buddhism, a Buddhism adapted to the spiritual needs of the West, is already in process of emergence. Like my essay, The Meaning of Orthodoxy in Buddhism, a Protest, the ecumenical views expressed in the concluding sentences of this extract scandalized a few people. They gave particular offence to those Theravadins who believed that Buddhism in the West should be simply a transplanted Sinhalese or Thai Buddhism, cultural trappings and all, and to whom the idea of a distinctive Western Buddhism was anathema. The retreat came 2 weeks after Wesak, and was, I think, a smaller and quieter affair than the Easter retreat. Terry was on it with me, while among the other retreatants were Antoinette, Mrs. Mills, Emile Boyne, and two elderly married couples. The programme was of the same mixed type as before, the only difference being that this time there were two tape-recorded lectures a day, one in the morning and one in the evening, an arrangement that some people preferred. I did not attend the lectures, which in any case were ones I had given myself. Instead, I stayed in my room clearing up arrears of correspondence, while Terry conducted proceedings downstairs. At most other times, I was with the retreatants. Besides leading all the meditation sessions, I saw them at meals and was available for personal interviews. Mrs. Mills, who confessed to having a problem with repressed anger and who came to see me more than once, was a schoolteacher. She was also the mother of Bhikkhu Kantipala, who had once spent a few months with me in Kalimpong before moving on to Thailand, and to whom, as it happened, I was then writing to ask if he could come to England for a while during my absence in India. Emil Boyne, who came to see me on the last day of the retreat, and whom I strongly suspected of also having a problem with repressed anger, was the proprietor of Sakura, the Japanese shop in Monmouth Street, upon which I had stumbled the previous summer. As one might have expected, he was interested in Zen, though he never attended any of my meditation classes and had not been on retreat with me before. He was constant in his attendance at my Sunday lectures, however, besides being a lively, if controversial, contributor to the pages of the Buddhist. His pseudonymous, in brackets, M. Eel, close brackets, article called Sentimentality, Samurai, Violence, Vegetarianism, with its blunt assertion that Buddhism is not beamed at a little group of sentimental old women, but at mankind as a whole, and its caustic reference to, quote, the old girl shedding a tear for her deceased cat while relishing a leg of lamb, prompted an immediate rejoinder from Morris, which, in its turn, led to a whole series of letters to the editor of the association's little monthly journal. The fact of the matter was that Emil was an idealist, and if he had a problem with repressed anger, it was because he was a frustrated idealist. He was an idealist in that he had an ideal, the ideal being the mental picture he had formed of what a British Buddhist movement ought to be like. And he was a frustrated idealist in that this ideal had found no concrete embodiment. It was not that he was critical just of the British Buddhist movement, but the sentimentalised, emasculated pseudo-Buddhism of the type he had handled so roughly in his article. He was critical, indeed bitterly critical, of the Sangha Association as it had been before my arrival, and of the Buddhist Society as it had been, was now, and according to him, always would be. Walsh he regarded as an old woman, Humphreys as a fraud, and though he faithfully attended my lectures at the Vihara, the society he eschewed, he was far from believing that the problems facing British Buddhism could be solved simply by healing the breach between the two rival organisations, a breach which, despite my efforts, still existed to an extent. What Emile really wanted, I suspect, even at that time, was a new Buddhist movement, a movement that would make a quantum leap to the next stage of the development of Buddhism in Britain, leaving both the Sangha Association and the Buddhist Society far behind. But of such a movement, there was no sign. Shortly after our return from Biddulph, Terry and I spent an evening in Southfields with my father and Auntie Florrie, whom we found concerned about the war in Vietnam. This was followed a few days later by an afternoon and evening at Rayleigh and Southend, with my mother and sister and my sister's two youngest children, 12-year-old David and 18-month-old Kamala. We also paid a visit to Veronica, who seemed rather upset. She was upset, it later transpired, because she had been under the impression that the following week we too would be leaving for India, not for Greece, and that she would be meeting up with us in Calcutta. How the misunderstanding arose, I do not remember, if I ever knew, but in recent months it had become increasingly obvious that I featured in Veronica's plans much more than she featured in mine. I had one old friend who had close ties with both Greece and India. This friend was, of course, Marco Pallas, of whom I had seen little or nothing since sharing the platform with him at the Buddhist Society's WASAC meeting the previous year. A fortnight before the meeting with Veronica, however, I lunched with him and his friend Richard Nicholson at their Knightsbridge flat, where we talked at length about our much-loved Kalimpong, to which I would soon be paying a farewell visit, and about the friends we had in common both there and in neighbouring Sikkim and Bhutan. There were other reminders of my Indian past about this time. One of them was a visit I received from Rechung Rinpoche, who showed me his translation of the first part of a Tibetan medical text. Another was a visit from amiable, scholarly Mother Fisk, an American Roman Catholic nun I had met in Pune, where she was doing research into the meaning of religion and Buddhism among what she termed India's new Buddhists. Thus the days between our return from Biddulph and our departure for Dover passed quickly, both for me and for Terry. Not only were visits paid and received, we had trips to make to the AA, to the bank, and to the bookshops, where we stocked up on classical authors, besides which I had my usual classes to take and lectures to deliver. I also hosted a reception at the Vihara. About 60 people turned up, including representatives of some of the provincial Buddhist groups, so that it was fortunate that the weather was fine and we were able to get out into the garden. In the course of the afternoon, I managed to talk for a few minutes with everyone present, which left me feeling a little exhausted, though after a short outing to Kenwood with Terry, Alan and Paul, the young Adonis with the Yorkshire accent, I was sufficiently refreshed to be able to have a long talk with Alf and his family, Mike and Jack, and after they had left with Terry, Alan and Viria. The last few days passed quickest of all. We were to leave on the Sunday in the evening. On Wednesday, after lunching with Antoinette, I checked the dummy of the June issue of The Buddhist, which included the Vihara's programme for July. The June programme had appeared the previous month, and saw a young man who had embarked on a fast. Thursday, Terry and I spent packing and clearing up the flat, which we were vacating. On Friday, our packing done, we took several boxes of Terry's belongings round to the Vihara and stored them in my cupboards, after which I left Terry to finish moving out of the flat while I went and took my meditation class at the Buddhist Society. On Saturday, Terry having left for Ilford, I spent the morning clearing my desk and the afternoon attending part of the Society's weekend conference of provincial Buddhist groups. Sunday was, of course, lecture day at the Vihara. I spent the morning writing my notes, talking with Virya, Bill and Alf in the afternoon, and at 5:30 gave what, for the time being, would be my last lecture. It was entitled Buddhism and the New Reformation, and was by way of being a successor to Buddhism and the Bishop of Woolwich. After the lecture, I spoke to a few people. Terry returned from Ilford, and half an hour later, after I had given Virya some final instructions, Tien Chao was away in Paris, we left in the little bus. Both very happy to be off, my diary records, headed south.